Good morning. Well, hope you are having a wonderful July 4th weekend with family and with friends. Thank you for those of you who are coming along with us in this series on Jesus stories from afar. And welcome again to Lakeshore Road Baptist Church family. I want you to think with me this morning about the treasure trove of Jesus stories that we find lodged in the text of Luke's gospel. And we've been looking in these past 3 weeks, and this will be our fourth week today, at the concentration of parables, Jesus stories that Luke has set in chapter 15. In fact, these three parables lodged in Luke 15 are birthed and spawned out of a context of conflict. If you remember, if you go back to the opening verses of this chapter, that Jesus is keeping company with the riffraff, the outcasts. He is meeting and greeting and teaching and eating with the Tellonai, the tax collectors, and also with the hamartoloi, the sinners, those that were considered beyond the pale in Pharisees' eyes and in the scribes' eyes. And the Pharisees and the scribes are dismayed. In fact, the word that is used here is, just as a reminder, the word that is used is gongodzo. Sounds like what they're doing. It's onomatopoetic, it's a thorough gonging. It's a murmuring. It's a grumbling. It's a complaining at the actions of Jesus in receiving those who should be on the margins, those that should never have audience with Jesus, those who should be a constituency that Jesus would not fraternize with in any sense. The fact that Jesus is receiving them, the fact that Jesus is having table fellowship with them, is indicative of the mission of God. And in this setting of the context of conflict, Luke provides us with three Jesus stories as to the heartbeat of God, how God's heart is defined and described in reaching out to those that would be thrown away, those that are anonymous, those that are the untouchables in Jesus' day, are ones that he touches. He eats with them, table fellowship. That's a gesture of enormous friendship and social intimacy, social bonding. And this is just absurd, and anathema is a stronger word, to the religious establishment of that day. But this is how different the world and the religious view of the leaders, spiritual leaders of that day, might be in contrast to Jesus' perspective. So today we come to the parable that deals with this lost coin. And I think we need to understand that as we look at this parable, this is by some the middle child. It's a neglected parable. We focus on the lost sheep, one out of 100. We focus on the prodigal son or the two lost sons or the father. But we tend to miss out or to neglect or to pass by this little parable, which is found in these three verses of Luke 15, 8, 9, and 10. It's like the fourth stanza in a five stanza hymn. In order to speed up, we'll drop out that fourth stanza. Well, in some instances, we find that this parable, this Jesus story, is bypassed, and it has much to teach us. In fact, all of these parables do. These parables set up this one who is born in Bethlehem, which means the house of bread, is now breaking bread with the broken. And each one of these three stories has a theme. The theme of found. That which was lost has been found, and that issues forth in great joy in heaven and in the heart of God. And so against this, these backgrounds of these parables that Jesus sets up his manifesto, how he's going to do mission, how he's going to do life, how he will work out his ministry to the last, the least, and the last. We come to the final story in Luke 15. It's really in the middle, but it's the one that I'm teaching last. Jesus basically says, before we get into this story, if you ask me why I'm concerned with those that you would be unconcerned for, if my concern seems to be to the broken and the battered and the bruised in life, the outcasts, you ask me why the focus on the social outcasts, here's my response: because they are God's concern, and the Son does the mission of the Father. So the Son of Man, the Jesus that walks Galilee and Judea, this Son of Man is willing to be called the friend of sinners and identifies with them. Now, I've traveled along Highway 1 on the West Coast, and it's a beautiful highway. I've driven down from San Francisco down to Monterey, and I've walked Pebble Beach. It was too expensive to play. Driven further down south towards, not very much further, but seen the Lone Cypress. And then didn't go into Carmel, which Clint Eastwood used to be the mayor for some years. But that's a beautiful drive. I'd love to do more of that drive one day and go further up into Oregon and Washington State up Highway 1. But if I can be so bold as to argue, one of the most beautiful, if not the most beautiful drive that I've encountered in my life has been what we call that drive along Chapman's Peak from Hout Bay, a beautiful bay. Hout Bay means wood bay. To Noordhoek, to North Corner. That's what Noordhoek means, North Corner. It's a 5-mile drive along the Atlantic side, reaching nearly to the tip of the African continent. And as you drive above these massive cliffs and look down on the Atlantic Ocean, you are going to be met with 114 curves or corners within 5 miles. So you got to be wide awake. You really need to be a passenger to absorb the beauty and not to give your passengers a scare as you, as driver, are observing the beauty. But I've noticed in that drive that I've taken many times, the moods of the Atlantic Sea. And if you look at the Atlantic Ocean when you drive along this Chapman's Peak Drive, and the sun is out, the sea sparkles, you have the colors in the waters of turquoise, blues, azure. But I've driven down that highway and that beautiful drive on a cloudy day when it's overcast. And now the sea is not blue and green and azure and turquoise, but slate gray, dull. I've also driven along that time, that highway, in times of storm, and watch the fury of the waves build up and assault the cliff faces with their power, their raw power, and break upon the beaches. So you've got an ocean there along this drive with three different moods, depending on the climate. Well, here we step into three different parables with three different moods, although there's a single common denominator, and that is the searching, seeking God who, when he finds the lost, rejoices. So I want to get into how we've normally gone through the parable. But before we look at the picture half and the reality half, I want to read these three verses and then break them down for us. So reading from Luke chapter 15, from verse 8 through 10. Or what woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one coin, does not light a lamp and sweep the house and search carefully until she finds it? When she has found it, she calls together her friends and neighbors, saying, "Rejoice with me, for I have found the coin which I had lost." In the same way, I tell you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. If you notice the first word here in verse 8, it's the word "or," it's the conjunction "or." And really, I broke up the natural structure of the first and second parable. They are called twin parables. The lost sheep and the lost coin really go together, are tied together. But I take 45 minutes every sermon or teaching, and I couldn't do an hour and a half. So what I did was I broke it up unnaturally. But you've had this parable of the lost sheep, and now we have the parable of the lost coin. It's a twin parable. Luke has three instances of twin parables. If you reach back to Luke chapter 13 and you go to verses 18 through 21, you have an example of a twin parable. You have the mustard seed and the leaven. If you go to Luke chapter 14 and you go to verses 28 through 33, you have another example of a twin parable. You have the building of a tower, a high tower, and a king who is amassing his troops and seeing how he might have the strength for a battle or for a war. Here, when we come to Luke 15, in these three chapters, 13, 14, and 15, here is another twin parable. We have, what man among you, if you look at verse 4, and then in verse 8, or what woman? Very interesting. That Jesus is speaking to grumbling, complaining, murmuring religious leaders, and he uses provocative characters in his Jesus stories. He uses a shunned shepherd who goes out looking for a lost sheep. He uses an ordinary peasant Palestinian woman looking for a lost coin. He uses a father who violates every social protocol, throws out the taboos and etiquette in order to minister to both youngest and eldest son. So we have here in this second parable an ordinary Palestinian woman. This is a man's world. Remember this first century world. It's patriarchal. It's androcentric. And by metaphor, by analogy, this is the only parable that we could juxtapose with God. God has male qualities, if you read the Old Testament, male images, and female images, if you read Hosea carefully in the Psalms. And here we have Jesus using a parable, and he likens, in some sense, God to this woman who's doing a search. Well, let's talk about the economics of that world, the day in which Jesus lived. It was a day when there were no banks. The temples were the banks, but there were really no credit unions, and there was cash was rare. There were some coins. We found that through archaeological studies, and they are vital information for us in our understanding of that world. But in Jesus' day, coins were not flush. Coins were somewhat rare, particularly in the rural villages. You did life economically by trading in inventory, trading in commodities. You would trade fruit and vegetables, and grain, and barley, and wheat. You would trade in wool that had been shorn off lambs and sheep. You would trade in fish that had been caught in perhaps the Sea of Galilee. You would trade in different articles, in different kind. That gives you some clue as to the fact that here we've got a lost coin. And this coin that is lost is the Greek word that is used here is a drachma, D-R-A-C-H-M-A. It's a small coin, maybe a disc-shaped coin, not so circular, perhaps like a nickel. And this word is actually only used in the Greek New Testament in this particular place, drachma. The Roman equivalent or coinage was much more familiar to this Greco-Roman world in Jesus' day, and that was the denarius, the silver coin. And this silver coin, or this disc-shaped drachma, was the equivalent of one day's wage, one day's work out in the fields. Unskilled labor would be paid minimum wage, a drachma, at the end of the day. It's interesting that about 300 BC or BCE, you could buy one sheep especially in light of the parable that precedes, you could buy one sheep 3 centuries earlier for a drachma. If you were to pick up Tobit, which is a delightful apocryphal book, it's not part of a Protestant canon, but if you read Tobit, you would see that Tobit, the main character, is one who is visited by an angelic being, an angelic traveler. And he agrees to pay Azarias, one drachma a day. And so we've got some understanding of this coin. We know that 4 drachmas would be equal to a shekel. Now, the average 20-year-old male Jew would pay half a shekel into the temple treasury tax per year. So 2 drachmas, in a sense, would be equivalent to that half a shekel. Well, here's the Jesus part, the Jesus story's picture half. We have a woman who owns 10 drachmas. You can use drachmai as the plural or drachmas. And she discovers that out of that 10, she has lost one. One of the coins has gone missing. Now, we can think of this coin as having some significance. We're not given any clues as to her economic status. We're just told that she has this house and she's going to look for this coin. But there may be some significance here, particularly when we understand the subsistence living and the hardness of eking out a life economically in that day. And if one lost a drachma, in a sense, one lost a day's wage. One did not eat that day. So there's some significant value to this coin that has been lost. I would argue, too, that there's some sentimental value. There's sentimental value in the fact that she has, as some commentators write, and archaeologists who found coins, have argued that they have found necklaces with coins pieced together with holes. So you might have a necklace with 10 drachmas. Or they've even found, and this is more Bedouin women than Jewish women, they found 10 coins with a headband. In fact, they found many coins in headbands. And so if you've lost one coin in your necklace or one in your headband, you've upset the symmetry. And this has sentimental value. Let me explain. The drachmas in the necklace or the headband would have been part of a bride's dowry. It was something that she brought to the marriage. It had not just the sentimental value, but it had the symbolic sentimental value of being the equivalent of a wedding ring, an engagement ring. It was a marked symbol of matrimony, of being betrothed and married. And so there's this significant value, this sentimental, symbolic value of this drachma that's missing, besides the fact that it's going to upset the symmetry. There'll be one of the coins missing in the headband or the necklace. It is also, I think there's this significant value, sentimental value, and there is also security in the value of the coin. Some would keep their coins, not in a bank deposit box, but they would keep them. There were none, as I mentioned. They would put the coins underneath, buried maybe in a tree or buried on the floor of the house for a rainy day, for security. If there was drought in the land, if there was economic plight, the sluice gates of heaven were shut up, no maize, no crops. In times of desperate need, one could go to the money box and pull out a drachma or two to try to sustain one during that time of distress and hardship. So this coin is of some significance. And this woman is going to act. In terms of she is driven, no doubt, by anxiety in discovering the loss. And now she is going to look for this coin in its limited field of search. The one sheep that was lost, the shepherd leaves, or the one looking after the sheep, leaves the 99 in the open pasture, the open country, and goes off looking with a wide search field. In the parable of the two sons, the prodigal has gone to a distant country, and the father scans the horizon each day looking for the son to return. He's gone into a foreign land, an alien land, And here we have in this parable a woman who is limited in her search to the house, the domicile, the residence. And she is now going to search in this house, which was probably made of rocks or of cemented mud. And in this house, which has very little natural light, you didn't have glass windows back in those days. So if you had any light at all, it was that little low door that you came in through, or maybe an 18-inch window higher up to keep out this blistering Palestinian heat. Or you would want to keep out the rain, when occasionally you did get rains in the March and in the spring. So you've got darkness in the house. You've got a packed floor, or packed of dirt, packed with dirt, or perhaps even stone. And this drachma has rolled off and departed into a crevice or a crook or a cranny or corner of the house. Or sometimes the houses had reeds, bulrushes to across the floor to soften it up. And maybe this coin is hid somewhere in this darkness. And so what she does is she lights an oil lamp. Maybe just a little wick with oil, and she just lights that in the darkness. And she then gets her whisk broom, her little brushy broom that she's now going to sweep around in the house. And she begins she searches diligently. It's an interesting Greek word here. It means to search, to scour. It means to search painstakingly. It means to search with meticulousness. So this is a search that is done conscientiously, carefully, as she seeks to discover through the light of the lamp, maybe the glint of the coin, or through using her whisk broom to dislodge it and to hear the tinkle as it runs across the floor. The Aramaic word actually for this kind of coin was azusa, Z or Z-U-Z-E. And it was used of it literally means to depart or to roll away, which is the action of a coin when it falls. It departs and it rolls away. So she sets out on this diligent search for the coin. And she is confined in this house. That, as I said, is the range of her search. And on finding this coin, there is huge relief. There is huge joy. And she invites her friends who had been in her house before. She invites her friends and her neighbors to come and to celebrate with her. In fact, one commentator has said here, he's actually a scholar of the rabbis, J.M. Derrett. Derrett writes a lot about Jewish law. And Derrett explains that here there was double joy. Because once it was known that this coin was missing, in the community, there would be a pall, P-A-L-L, a pall of suspicion. There would be clouds of wonderment as to, was this coin lost or was this coin appropriated, stolen? And when the coin is found and located, then the coast is clear. There's relief not only in the heart of the woman who is searched, but there's relief in the community. And there's a joy in the finding. Well, that is the picture Hoff has set out for us in this second parable. I want to now transition into three quick points with regard to the reality Hoff. The first one that I want to address is I want to talk about the lostness in our village. I want to talk about the lostness in our village. The sheep was lost through its own heedlessness. Do you remember it would begin to move from tuft to tuft and nudge itself into lostness through its lack of care? Here we got to be careful here, but we think that perhaps this coin was lost through accident or through carelessness. We surely know that the father has gone out to the rebellious sons, the sons who have both defied him, the youngest in going to the distant country, and the eldest who is more distant than, in a sense, the youngest, the prodigal. And even though he is at home, he is not at home. So we've got here the rebelliousness on the part of both sons in that third parable. So when we come to the lostness in the village, I begin to think of a number of different things. I begin to think of those days when I was a philatelist as a young boy, collected stamps. But I wonder if any of you are numismatics. Numismatists. 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 Coin collectors. I was looking at coins this morning and just looking at gold and silver and looking at the issuing of gold coins. And when you come to gold and silver, you have a troy ounce. A troy ounce is more than a normal ounce in terms of weight. And the gold and silver are sold in troy ounces. If you wanted a South African Kruger Rand on the market today, it would cost you $1,872 for one troy ounce of gold. I'm sure you wanted to hear that this morning. But anyway, when you see these issues of gold coins, in South Africa it was of Paul Kruger or Springbok. Gold coins issued in America often have the bald eagle. In Canada, gold coins have the maple leaf. In China, the panda. Well, here you know when you, if you've ever bought a gold coin that's been issued, that gold coin just sparkles. It's just polished and it gleams. You can really see your face in the coin. But as you touch the coin, it becomes smudged. And the more and more you use the coins, the more that polish comes off and the coin seems to dull somewhat. When we think about it in our world today, in our village, think of the lost children. Think of the lost teenagers. Think of the lost adults. The image of God has all but been marred and defaced. That image can be traced back to the Creator. But it's almost as though Satan's graffiti and the decisions that we've made in our life have marred the coin, defaced the coin. It amazes me that we have so many children that we invest so much time and money in terms of teaching them how to play the violin, the piano, ballet, dance, how we get them to play, go to sports camps, soccer, basketball, tennis, all kinds of investments in teaching our children how to be skilled, academic lessons in tutoring in Latin or math or English, helping them to succeed on one level. But we seem to ignore the fundamental level, which is the spiritual level, which is lost. I think back on the incredible gift I had as a young boy of a family that had family altar devotions each morning, a family that had a father that on Sunday afternoons would get out his flannel graph board. You don't even probably know what that is these days, but you would put on these felt characters onto the board. And my dad would teach us the Bible stories, the Adam and Eve story of how this couple seized at equality with God, grasped at equality with God, was sent down to exile when God slammed shut the gates of paradise, of Eden, of Noah in the flood, of Abraham offering up in the binding of Isaac and God staying his hand, the patriarchal stories, Jacob and Esau and Joseph, and how God protected him from pit to prime minister. Joshua going into Moses and Joshua going into the promised land. And Gideon and the tragedy of Samson, David slaying Goliath. The Bible stories, being biblically literate, theologically literate. We need to recover. There's a lostness among our children, a theological illiteracy. They are devoid of the foundation that they can use to build their lives by becoming familiar with the scriptures in the biblical text. So there's a lostness in a sense there. Billy Collins was the U.S. Poet Laureate from 2001 to 2003. And I want to quote him. He says, all babies are born with a knowledge of poetry because the lub-dub of the mother's heart is in iambic poetry. Say that again. All babies are born with a knowledge of poetry because the lub-dub of the mother's heart is in iambic poetry. And then he continues. Then life slowly seeks, starts. Then life slowly starts to choke out the poetry in us. Too many of us have lost that poetry in our lives. The burden of life, the circumstances of life, the grief of life. We've lost the spiritual poetry in us. That image of God that was supposed to burn with brightness, with brilliance, with signature, God's signature. But life slowly starts to choke out the poetry in us. Yet the shepherd, the woman, the father search for the lost. No matter how mangled that son or daughter might be, no matter how marred, people have that trace of God's image within them. Every person has value in God's eyes. Every person has value in God's heart and is worth seeking and searching for. So we have here, first, a reminder that there are lost in our village. Do you know them? Do you know that young boy, that young girl that you teach, the student that you teach, who seems not to have a clue how to put life together, searching in all the dead-end streets? That adult that's lost his or her way? The world that offers us an autobahn that's wide, that leads to destruction. We tend to ignore the narrow road that leads to life. If you see the lost and you notice the lost, our responsibility is to be involved in taking the good news to the lost. The father went searching, seeking. The shepherd went searching, seeking. We also find the woman went searching for that silver coin. The second truth is that of a searching God. A searching God. What I ask is God's answer to derelict humanity, broken, battered humanity. It's the whisper of God's grace. God comes searching and seeking. And Jesus argues in these three Jesus stories, in his parables, from the lesser to the greater, from the lighter to the heavier. And he argues this way by posing a series of rational, rhetorical questions. He draws the reader and the hearer in to the Jesus story. And he says, what man among you? What woman? And in this particular parable, We hear these rhetorical questions. But let's pick them up in the first one. What man among you has 100 sheep and one is found to be lost? Does he not leave the 99 in the open pasture and go and search for that lost sheep until he finds it? How much more, Jesus argues in this parable, how much more from the lighter, the sheep, to the person? How much more valuable is the lost person to God? The rhetorical questions in the parable that we're examining now. What woman, if she has 10 silver coins and loses one of them, what will she do? Well, she will light the lamp or that candle. She will sweep the house and she will search diligently for the coin until it is found. Jesus' point. How much more valuable are you in the heart and the eyes of God than that lost coin? I've had the privilege of walking around and spending 2 months on a sabbatical at Oxford. And I remember on Sundays, I would walk into different colleges. You could visit them. There are some famous ones: Christ College, St. John's College, Magdalen College, and the Jesus College. But there's also one called the Keble College. The architecture at Keble College is controversial because it is completely different to the Cotswold Reds. It's done in a Victorian Gothic style. And this Keble College was started in the 19th century. It was meant to be a college for clergymen, but it's become a college for all comers now. But it was a college for the poor. And it was a college that was built from the subscriptions of people in England in the British Isles. The motto of the college is plain living and high thinking. Plain living and high thinking. But here's where I want to go. Next to that college, Keble College, it was opened in 1870. You have a beautiful chapel, magnificent chapel. If you're ever in Oxford, you need to go and see the Keble Chapel. And in the Keble Chapel with its massive ceilings, there is a painting done by William Holman Hunt. You've heard of this painting. It was the original painting done in the latter years of 1840 and completed in around 1853. And this whole William Holman Hunt painting of the light of the world hangs in Keble College. That's the original. There is another one in St. Paul's Cathedral that was done later on in Holman Hunt's life that hangs in St. Paul's Cathedral in London. But the one at Keble College in the chapel has this picture that you've all seen with Jesus carrying a lantern in his left hand and him knocking on this door with his right hand. The door looks padlocked, sealed, and there's no handle to turn from the outside. It's deliberately been left. This painting is full of allegory and meaning. And the idea is that of Jesus who comes searching, seeking, and only the lost, the prodigal, the youngest, the eldest son, daughter, can open the heart to God, the searching, seeking, knocking God that comes with his whispers of grace into our lives. God takes the initiative for restoration. And the timeless truth then in Jesus' day and now is the same. And Jesus dared to say it back in his day, that this God of the infinite cosmos, this God who has thrown down the bricks and mortars of the universe, this God who has set the boundaries of the oceans, this God who has flung the stars out into space, the God whose throne we know not where, the God who is everywhere, that God comes searching, seeking, knocking on the door. Between I-92 and I-40, between 11E, that God comes searching, seeking, in our lost village. And he intends to use us as instruments in that search. You might ask me, how does God search? How does God come seeking? Well, let me give you a few answers to that. God comes first through what we would call general revelation. God comes through the visible characteristics and features of nature. And through the visible features and characteristics of nature, look where we live, the beauty of Cherokee and Douglas Lake, the hills, the mountains, the Appalachian Mountains. Through those visible characteristics of nature, we catch a glimpse, a mirror of the invisible characteristics of a divine creator. We see in nature the fingerprints, the footprints, clues to God, an architect. But there's not merely the general revelation of God's search that is available to each one of us. as witnesses of creation. There's also special revelation. God has given us his word, the written word, 66 books in this library. And as we read the text, it breathes life, it breathes meaning, it breathes nuance, it touches the core of our being, it speaks into our existential questions of our life journey. It gives us purpose and meaning. We know the richness of the texture of God's revealed word for us, recorded for us. And then, of course, we have the special revelation of Jesus, the intuitive presence of God that we understand in this relationship that we have with him through the journey of life. We do not travel alone. We travel in the presence of God's Spirit and in the presence of his love. Think of the cemetery. God reveals himself through the gravestones, through the headstones, the grave markers. He reminds each one of us when we go there that our lives are mortal, that we're fragile, that life is but a vapor, a hevel, a wisp. It's vacuous and empty without God, and then it's gone. Yeah, but for the blink on the screen of history. He reveals himself to us through the hymns, the hymnals, the rich pulse of the heartbeat of the faith community back in their moment of history, when we sing hymns and we listen to choir pieces that have been written by generations in the past. He searches and he seeks through the providence of life as the encirclement of life circumstances come upon us, the valleys, the steep hills, the mountains. God works in the contingencies and the circumstances of our lives. He teaches us in the laboratory of life. We learn to see God's whisper, God's person in the birth of a baby, this little gift of creaturehood, this little person that God deposits and asks the young man and young woman to make space in their lives for. It brings so much joy to grandparents. These little lives that God speaks into, how they're beautifully formed, the fingers and the toes, the little toes, just the beauty of God's creation, the reminder. God comes seeking, God comes searching, God comes to the village looking for the lost. God comes knocking on the door. He challenges you and I to get moving on the mission of God. The purpose of the church is to share where the lost might find the living water, the bread of life. Well, the third reality principle is that finding creates boundless joy. Finding creates boundless joy. I was reading about Ludwig van Beethoven recently, born on the 17th of December, 1770, grew up in a home where his father was a drunkard who beat him, and his mother died when he was 17 of tuberculosis. That was his closest friend. And now at the age of 17, he went to Vienna and he sat down under the tutelage of Mozart for a couple of months or so. And Mozart said, with regard to this young man, take note of him, notice this person, because he is going to take the world by storm. Let me get the quote exactly right here. Mozart said, watch this lad. Someday he will force the world to talk about him. And we know how Beethoven went through that troublesome life and turmoil of his life. And before he died on that March 26th, 1827, at the age of 57, or just short of 57, before he died on that Monday at 5:45 in the evening in the midst of a thunderstorm, he wrote in 1824 his final symphony, Symphony 9 in D minor. And in the midst of that fourth movement is that wonderful Ode to Joy, where he took a poem in the text and put music to it in one of the greatest music compositions. this man with giftedness, this man who spoke of joy, this man whose funeral was attended by 20,000 people in Vienna. And yet God speaks of a different kind of joy in a way. There's a joy in the finding. God speaks in each one of these three Jesus stories through his son of a Jesus who knows about heaven, a Jesus who knows what heaven's about and knows something about a father, who knows something about a father's heart that responds with deep and profound joy when a sinner, a lost one, comes home. When that person walks the aisle in an invitation in a church service and kneels at the foot of the cross, there is great joy in the heart of God. God, yes, we often think is somewhat just. He is just. He seems sometimes to be stern or austere. But he's a God of love, and this God of love has a heart that we need to understand is a heart of joy. The seeking, searching Father finds joy in the sinner that comes home. In fact, you can hear the peals of joy break across heaven's courtyards when one sinner kneels at the foot of the cross. The applause of heaven. How different. How different is this chasm where we started Luke chapter 15? This chasm that exists, if you go to the Lazarus and the rich man in Luke 16:26, this chasm after death between the rich man in Hades and Lazarus in Abraham's bosom in the presence of God. How great this chasm, this gulf between the Pharisees and the kingdom that Jesus defines, the kingdom of God, is a gulf that which brings complaint and grumbling and murmuring and animus out of the hearts of the Pharisees, the sinners, liars. Those sinners that repent become part of the joy of God's kingdom. The Pharisees with their spiritual dyspepsia, indigestion, and yet this wonderful joy that we find in the heart of God. When you come home, when I come home, let us pray. Father, as we travel into this next week, help us to understand that there are lost in our village. Open our eyes, open our hearts and minds, we pray. Give us courage to share the good news that the seeking Father brought to this world through this Jesus, the Son of God, Son of Man, who went to Golgotha and became the Passover Lamb, the Lamb sacrificed, the Lamb given as a substitutionary offering so that we might be redeemed and rescued and found. For it's in your name that we pray. Amen. God bless you and enjoy the rest of today and be careful.